Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's the weekly program that looks at science and technology in our everyday lives. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with my co-host John Wells. Well, have you ever played the video game NeuroRacer? Well, probably not. Not unless you're over the age of 65. That's right. And our first guest, Dr. Molly Wagster, is a neuroscientist at the National Institute of Aging. And she'll talk about how video games for an aging population can stave off dementia, depression, and keep the brain nimble and even young.
And good morning, Lynn. I'm John Wells. Next, is disregarding all genetically modified food akin to throwing the baby out with the bathwater? We'll speak with the senior editor of the publication Nature Biotechnology, Laura DeFrancesco, who will help us unravel the science behind genetically modified foods and tell us why there's really a consensus or there's really little consensus that exists among regulators and food safety experts as to what constitutes proof of safety when it comes to genetically modified foods. Our two guests in today's cool story, when we return, you are listening to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Jan, I think I'm falling for the show.
John, are you hurt?
Nothing a little fun can't cure.
Fall into Fun on Fridays from 9 to 10 a.m.
Find out on Fun Friday what to do this fall. Brought to you by All Seasons Adventures,
Park Silly Sunday Market,
Zermatt Resort and Spa,
and the Homestead Resort.
No hosts were hurt in the making of this ad.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with John Wells. Well, it's not just crossword and jigsaw puzzles anymore down at the Senior Center. You may be finding video games as part of the repertoire that keeps a brain function active and healthy. And now joining us to talk about how an aging population can stay young, not just by walking a few miles a day, but possibly by playing video games. It's neuroscientist Dr. Molly Wagster from the National Institute on Aging. And welcome to Cool Science Radio, Molly.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's nice to have you. And I guess the best way to set up this conversation may be for you to tell us what exactly happens to the brain as we age. We know it's, in a sense, it's a muscle, and you know, the old, if you don't use it, you lose it. But what really happens?
Well, there are many changes that occur in the brain as we age, ranging all the way from the molecular to very large changes that may occur. Many of these changes, though, that happen with what we call normal aging, or aging in the absence of real pathology or disease, are ones in which we have maybe a diminution of function of cells of different areas of the brain, but that don't mean a total loss of those cells. And so much of the research that we're engaged in here and that we support at the National Institute on Aging are trying to understand just what the question you ask, what are all of the changes, and how we might target those changes in an effort to bring the system back to its, full function.
So, Molly, on the other side of the spectrum, you know, and I'm sure in all of your research you've come across this, how much is it just being out of practice and, even maybe not having great confidence about using our brain when we stop, you know, after we're no longer in the workplace or when we just get a little lazy? I suppose there's a whole spectrum of things that happens that you've encountered.
That would be very difficult to pinpoint, Lynn, in terms of everyone's different, and many people, most people, I think, probably remain engaged even after they retire if they were, had a job outside the home. You probably have individuals that are still active in many arenas that they enjoy, reading, activities, hobbies that they may have engaged in before. They continue these things. So it would be very difficult to make general statements about that. I think most people look forward to the activities that they have and want to keep themselves active and engaged. I think you're probably referring to, you know, if we're not stimulated by work anymore, does that mean that we lose some of our edge? Or possibly if that's the direction in which you're going. I think we may find that there are age-related changes that occur in our cognitive performance, in our learning and memory, and that trying to keep stimulation, trying to keep interactions with others, social engagement, and engagement in cognitive activities, that this may help us maintain our brain function well into our older years.
Dr. Wagster, we're talking, of course, about healthy brains. A lot of our listeners have friends or family members that are suffering with dementia and some other types of diseases. What is the latest on that? And many of these listeners, of course, are concerned that that they may have inherited the genes or the ability to be able to contract these types of diseases as well. So, what is the latest on dementia?
Dementia is an umbrella term for a number of neurodegenerative diseases that have that as a component as we age. The most prominent one is Alzheimer's disease. There is an enormous amount of research ongoing today to try to understand the basis of Alzheimer's disease, some of the genetics behind it, as well as some of the lifestyle factors that could potentially maybe not enter into the, into actually the causes of the disease, but in terms of helping to prevent the disease or maintain function if the disease should set in. So there's an enormous amount of research going on, John, trying to understand still to this day the disease itself, what are the processes, how it progresses, and what may be the, in many cases, the molecular targets in the brain, the molecules that we could target to help devise therapies that would slow the progression of the disease or even prevent the disease from occurring.
Yeah. Is there any blue sky out there? Are there any studies that are currently going on that show promise?
There are an enormous amount of studies that show that are showing promise. It's a little too soon to tell. I can't give you, the answer. If we had the answer, you and I probably wouldn't be having this conversation. But there has been an enormous effort coming out of the White House in terms of focusing on Alzheimer's disease and other dementias of aging, because this is something that we see as individuals who may have these diseases growing in number as we progress through the next decade. And we want to make sure that we are prepared for the possible tsunami of individuals who may be showing signs of dementia and needing care. So there is research focused not only on the etiology of the disease or the cause of the disease and how to treat it, but also how to help individuals who are serving as caretakers for these individuals. So an enormous amount of research going on.
So after I read some of what you're working on with video games, I actually, it's funny, I always encourage my mother to listen to this show, but today I hope she's not listening because I had a conversation with her just this morning and planning a trip to Boston in a couple weeks with her, and she was so fixated on the possibility of getting lost in Boston and how bad it could be, and then telling stories about how she got lost in Denver for 2 hours. And, you know, I said, wow, Mom, you need to get out of Montana more often. But I think for those of us who have aging parents, this starts to make us wonder about, you know, is this the onset of dementia? I mean, she's going on and on and on about these things. Or is it just that she needs to belly up to a video game that takes her through, you know, some of these video games that I read about with the research you're doing really takes you back to this place of practice, a practice of keeping conscious and aware.
Yes, well, certainly that's important for all of us at any age. I think one thing that we haven't discussed this morning is what are the types of changes that we might expect to see in our behavior as we age, in our cognitive behavior, meaning our learning abilities and memory. And this is a question that, often, most older adults and middle-aged adults and even young adults have, because they're worried about the specter of a degenerative disease such as Alzheimer's disease. So it is the case from a number of research studies that have been supported by the National Institute on Aging and other organizations that we determined that there are what we would call normal age-related changes in our cognitive abilities, things that may be irritating to us, aggravating to mm-hmm. us in terms of being, of our everyday lives. But these are not changes that should impair our ability to carry out the functions of our everyday life. So in the study that you've referred to, where video game training was used to see if it could be exploited to enhance cognitive abilities or remediate cognitive abilities in older adults, this particular video game focused on an area that many of us will have trouble with as we age, which is multitasking. For some of us, that might be talking on the phone and working on the computer at the same time. For others, it might be, preparing a meal and getting all of the dishes, hot into the table at the same time, even though they require different cooking times. And be a number of things in our lives that require multitasking. Driving is another one of them, which this particular video game that you've mentioned incorporated, attending to road signs, things that pop up, mm-hmm. As well as concentrating on driving and staying on the road and staying in the lane. So there are many multitasking things in our lives, and it turns out that as we age, we often have some decline in that function. Sometimes we're able to compensate effectively and sometimes not. So interventions or training, such as this particular video game provided, may help us improve actually remediate any sort of declines that we may have in this particular area called multitasking.
So it's okay if you misplace your keys to your car every once in a while. The problem is when you forget that you even had a car, right?
That's exactly right, John. I mean, that's sort of an extreme example, but yes.
Levity this morning. That's all. Just having a little bit of fun. I'm really curious to hear about any results that you've quantified from NeuroRacer, because there seems to be a lot of rhetoric out there. There's a lot of products, commercial products, that claim that they can increase your memory or your skills and things like that. And we certainly want to highlight, a very positive product like yours. And at the same time, if you could tell us how people can be careful to stay away from the rhetoric.
Yes. Well, I must clarify that I was not involved in this research, but it is research that was supported by our institute, the National Institute on Aging. In reference to, you mentioned that there are a number of things out there, a number of products, particularly those that may purport to help improve our memory function, cognitive functions. Consumers should be wary of any claims that seem sort of too good to be true, no matter what the product is or what the area of improvement it is supposed to occur. It is difficult, I would agree, sometimes to judge the quality of those claims, particularly if you see that they were supported by scientific evidence, research. I think this particular case is that you're mentioning in terms of this NeuroRacer game. This is a prototype model. It is not something that is currently available, for purchase. This is something that was used strictly in an experimental way to not so much for the video game itself, but to try to use the video game mechanism or platform to design something that will really present, a challenge to the individual, and to see if by training and using that task over and over again, if it could actually improve function. So this is we've referred to this particular neural racer game several times during the conversation. I do want to emphasize that this is not something that is currently available to individuals for use. It was really used to demonstrate whether or not we would be able to help improve function by this type of game.
Okay, and I'm wondering, Dr. Wagster, if just the very nature of a practice of video games for an aging population is truly making us stretch, or making them stretch in a way that they never have before, and therefore, you know, even opening up an area of the brain that hasn't been triggered. And I guess what I'm referring to is, you know, maybe an aging population thinks, oh, I'm supposed to do jigsaw puzzles because that's going to keep my brain active. But the reality is they've done jigsaw puzzles their whole life. It's not really a challenge. Now, video games for that population may be something they've never done before. Is that part of what's, you know, what could possibly be working here?
The challenge or something new, can be part of it. But again, I would caution that this is not just any video game. This is a particular game that combines a lot of different stimuli and throws up a lot of what we would call interference for the individual who is playing the game or training on the game. So this is a complicated video game. It would be, I think, a little amiss if I were to say that, you know, any video game would give you the same desired result. This is a particular type, one that is using, again, multitasking or presenting a lot of interfering information to the individual, and they have to learn or train to be able to master this. So that is the particular key here. But in general, I think, they would indicate from research, both in animals, models, and in humans, that novelty, new things and new challenges can be particularly beneficial both to our brain and to our behavior.
Dr. Wagster, so much data and so much information has come to us in the last 10 or 15 years on brain research, but it's opened up even more questions. For all the research that you do, what question would you like to see answered before you go?
Before I go? Well, I think that what I would
pretty,
say...
Pretty good with words, aren't I?
I
should be on the radio.
Well, one of the things
you're not
that
going
I would
anywhere,
like,
Molly.
One of the things that I would like to bring up is that I think that, and again, emphasized by this particular research paper that you're highlighting in this conversation, is the what we're beginning to understand, and I do emphasize beginning to understand, is what may be sort of the untapped and rather extraordinary plasticity of the older brain. The ability of the older brain to adapt and to sort of grow in quotes, remediate itself or compensate and learn new ways or function differently so that proper function in a variety of areas, not just cognitive function, but motor function and sensory function and emotional function, so that can be maintained as we age and functioning well. So this notion of sort of pushing the envelope on what is the extent of plasticity or positive plasticity in the older brain, now how can we define that? How can we, you know, learning what are the ways to sort of stimulate that plasticity and harness it, you know, get it under control and get that plasticity to help us or to help the individual maintain or even remediate or reverse cognitive changes that may occur. That's where I think some of the most interesting research questions lie, where, you know, a frontier that we still have to really push on, and I think it will be, my hope is that it will be extraordinarily productive and extraordinarily meaningful for the lives of older adults.
It'd also be great to know what environment is conducive to brain growth, to encourage people, and I'm not saying that this is the environment, but a certain type of exercise, certain types of food, trying to keep stress down. I mean, I don't know what the factors are, but if we understood those better, the environment that would promote this type of activity, that would be good as well.
I couldn't agree with you more. We have a number of investigators who are actively pursuing these areas, and I think it's also important to pitch in that, you know, any one of these things may be, it's certainly probably important for us to maintain our cognitive and other behavioral functions as we age, or health in general. We may not have the final answer on whether or not, many of the things that you just mentioned specifically improve our cognitive function with age or help reverse any age-related declines, but we know that they're important for our health in general. But it may be not just a single factor, but a combination of factors. And that's another thing that investigators are really pushing on now, to see if the combination of factors, or what combination of factors, to engage in dietary, social interactions, pharmacological compounds that might be used in conjunction with aerobic exercise, video games or cognitive training in general. What are the things that really help us, and is it best to do them in combination? And one other thing that I will say is that it may not be one size fits all either. So what might be good for me and work for me and help me maintain my brain function may not be the exact same formula that works for you. And so when a lot of our investigative efforts are moving toward trying to determine individual differences and what may be the way to help individuals maintain their function as they age.
I think this research is really promising and really exciting. And the reason is that, you know, we hear so much about our bodies, and we hear how, you know, when we get past a certain age, muscle tone and balance and different, you know, motor functions decrease by a certain percentage each year, kind of no matter what we do, but we need to kind of keep going to help diminish or mitigate those declines. But here, knowing that the brain and learning that it's more, that has more plasticity, it can keep improving and keep adapting, is some of the most promising things that I've heard this week, maybe all month.
To me, it is. I find the more that we're learning about the older brain, the more we're learning that there is a capacity there that can be tapped, or hopefully can be tapped. And this, I think, should provide great encouragement for all. I also have seen from a number of our research studies that we support, and I say this with a little bit of caution, but I still think that we have a number of indicators that it is in many cases not too late to engage in some of these lifestyle factors that we've mentioned, and help maintain or even improve. We're focusing on cognitive function right now, but help and maintain or improve those abilities. I fear that sometimes people will get the message that if they didn't engage in a lifetime of aerobic physical activity, or, you know, nutritious and healthy diet, or didn't attend, you know, Yale University and receive an MD and a PhD, that they're just doomed and there's no turning back. But I think from what we're seeing about the, again, not to emphasize this too much, but the adaptability or the plasticity of the older brain, and studies that have actually shown that in older adults who may not be engaged in a lot of cognitively stimulating activities or exercise, that when they do, they show benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that another sort of, maxim to be had here is that it may not be too late, or maybe it's never too late. And if we would encourage people to, if they're not already engaged in these activities, to consider taking them up, and that there probably are multiple benefits that they will receive from them.
Dr. Wagster, we certainly know there's a lot of research going on the type of diet or the type of exercise or, you know, these, you know, the environment type things that we were talking about. But I'm curious, with people going to not as much face-to-face communication and everyone grabbing their devices and texting and all those sorts of things. Are there any studies that are looking at the benefits of personal communication versus this electronic age? Is there one form of communication which is better for plasticity of the brain?
I'm not aware of any studies in older adults that are comparing, those different arenas. I think that what you bring up is very important, and I can only imagine that there will be research directed toward those very questions because, you know, electronic communication has become and is still being, you know, is still a very significant portion of our lives today. And we have a generation of, you know, of currently older adults who may not have even engaged in that type of electronic communication.
Right, right.
Nor do they currently engage in it. And, you know, how will this compare on compared to, you know, younger adults and sort of their lifetime of engaging in this type of thing and outcomes in older age for them as, compared to the cohort now who has not had access to or need for access to that type of communication. These are all unanswered questions, very important ones that I think that we need to know much more and emphasizes the need to continue research in these areas.
Well, the big takeaway is it's never too late to improve cognitive abilities, and I think that's a great message. And Dr. Molly Wagster, thanks so much for your time today. It's a fascinating subject.
It's my pleasure and one that I love to talk about, so thank you very much for having me.
All right.
Well, we'd also like to have you back at some point because things are changing so quickly, and we'd love to have you as a guest again.
Well, thank you very much. I'd love to.
Thank you. Again, that's Dr. Molly Wagster. She is a neuroscientist with the National Institute on Aging. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back with Laura DeFrancesco. She is the senior editor of the publication Nature Biotechnology, and we'll be talking about genetically modified food. Stay with us.
The Spur Bar and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, the Spur features live music, cocktails, and Southern Pub Grub every evening starting at 3 p.m. Our website, thespurbarandgrill.com, includes music schedules, menus, and contact information. You must be 21 years or older to enter.
Many know that Botox can help with migraines, but don't know where to turn for qualified headache care. Locally, Dr. Andy Talbot can help ease the life-altering headaches with Botox treatment. Park City Spine and Pain Clinic is an Intermountain healthcare facility with highly skilled pain management providers. If migraines are a concern, they can help at 435-658-7470. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. Americans have been eating genetically modified foods for over a decade in things like corn. Syngenta's insect-protected corn was approved in 1998, and Monsanto came out 3 years later with a similar product. Now, genetically modified crops are the most highly regulated foods in the world. Some have called to relax the restrictions. Some think, well, maybe GMOs shouldn't exist at all. The food safety regulatory framework and health concerns of critics of GMOs that relate to this question are examined in an in-depth feature article published this week in this month's issue of Nation Biotechnology. And its author, Laura DeFrancesco, is now joining us by phone. Good morning, Laura, and welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me. I just want to point out that the journal is called Nature Biotechnology.
Oh, got it. Yeah.
Print. That was my misprint.
We got a misprint.
We knew that.
Yeah, I've got the article right here in front of me. So
just wanted to get it straight.
Yeah, I'm glad. Let me ask you, where do you think GMOs cross the line and produce so many strong opinions? I'm thinking about even before genetically modified foods. Farmers for years have been breeding crops to get, you know, improved taste, improved yield, improved disease resistance. All of these are good things. Why the lightning rod of opinions?
Well, you're absolutely correct, John. The plants that we eat have all been genetically modified in one way or another, from very simple techniques of crossbreeding that have been done for millennia up to very precise and technical ways of genetic engineering. And, you know, I can only speculate on why this has created such a furor, but I think the notion is that when you're actually going in and altering the genome of a plant, it's by these molecular techniques, that it's a different technology that's being, and new. It's something new that hasn't been done before. And proteins and enzymes that have never been in our food supply are being introduced into the food supply using these techniques, because that's exactly what they do. They insert foreign genes, for the most part, up till now anyway. They're inserting genes that haven't been produced in plants in them. And so I think the unease comes from the unfamiliarity with with the technology, for one thing, and for the kinds of changes that are being made to the genome of the plant. I think it's more of a philosophical argument than a scientific one.
I think you're absolutely right, and you point this out clearly in your article in Nature Biotechnology. So for an example, as kids, you know, our grandmother may have said, geez, I got some food poisoning today. So, or you hear it from your uncle, or you get it yourself, and we're all familiar with it. It's something that we know, that if you eat some food that may not be agreeable with you, that you could get food poisoning. Now we've got this new thing. It's the unknown. It's the X factor.
Right.
And people are, you know, a little anxious about what is new, about change.
Yeah, but you're also correct in pointing out that the real threat to the food supply comes from contamination of microbial, you know, bacteria and viruses. There are hundreds of thousands of cases of foodborne illnesses every year, and there have been no cases, nothing has been directly connected to a genetically modified food consumption in the decade or so that we've been eating them. However, I should point out that we really wouldn't know if there were.
Right.
Because mostly what we eat at the moment, what we're eating is genetically modified, are little bits of corn or soy that are in processed food. The only food that we eat that the whole food is genetically modified is some sweet corn and papaya. There's the papaya crop in Hawaii was saved from a viral infection that was decimating the crop by genetic modification. So papayas that are eaten are genetically modified, and some sweet corn that's in the market is genetically modified. But mostly we're eating it in very small quantities with embedded in with many other ingredients. So there really wouldn't be any way to know whether people are having a reaction to the genetically modified foods or not. This may all change because I think the nature of the products that are going to be produced in the future will be more towards consumer issues. The ones currently being grown are for farmers to improve their procedures, their herbicide tolerant and insect resistant. But companies are moving into changing the nutritional content of foods, which may be good in a way. It might convince people that genetically modified foods are good for them if they come up with foods that actually improve the nutrition of some foods. On the other hand, we're going to be eating them. The way we eat them is going to change over time as these foods get introduced into the food supply. So we're going to be eating more genetically modified in larger quantities at one time.
Well, we're eating 80% of our food right now is genetically modified, right?
Well, again, but it's embedded in processed food.
Right.
So we don't eat, as I said, except for sweet corn and papaya, we don't eat a genetically modified fruit, for example, although they are working on that. They're working on apples that resist browning, so there may come a time when we're eating a genetically modified apple.
Right.
Most of what is grown, over 95%, I think, of both soy and corn grown in this country is genetically modified, but most of it is for feed to animals. A very small proportion of it actually gets into the human food supply.
Okay, so there are many questions. You know, we could probably talk about this all morning. why don't you frame the central argument for us and and just sort of highlight what this is all about.
Okay, well, let me tell you how we got into this issue in the first place. I hope briefly that about a year ago, a paper was published that showed that if you fed rats a genetically modified corn that was resistant to an herbicide for 2 years, they developed tumors. Now, this created quite a furor. There's some horrible photographs of these large tumors in rats that were publicized broadly. And
nothing like a rat with a tumor to get you going, huh?
Right. But what you hear, this isn't the first time that papers like this have been published, and not even the first time for this particular group to have published this kind of work. And generally what you hear from plant scientists who are proponents of genetically modified food, genetic engineering of food crops, is that there are hundreds of independent studies that show that genetically modified crops are perfectly safe. So we ask the question, oh, so where are these hundreds of independent studies that show that genetically modified foods are safe? So we looked for them, and frankly, I couldn't find them. There are hundreds of papers, to be sure, that are published about some aspect or another of genetic modification. Some that look at the protein, some that look at whether it resembles an allergen or not. But when we actually drill down to find out what's the evidence that if you eat these things, that they're safe for human consumption, there's a very small literature on that. And it's all over the place. Some people fed things to rats. Some people fed things to mice. Some people fed things to hamsters, to goats, to pigs. I mean, and they looked at different things. If a laboratory had a technique for looking at testicular development, they would say, well, this is a really good way of seeing how safe something is because that's a very sensitive part of the human anatomy. So there's a small set of papers that looks at that. Somebody else was concerned about liver and kidney toxicity because those are the organs that detoxify. So if there were toxins, those would be the places to look for an effect. And so there's a little series of papers that looked at that. But by and large, there was no systematic review that did experiments that directly addressed whether consumption by humans was safe or not. There are lots of short-term feeding studies, small numbers of animals, but in terms of what long-term consumption, which we may be looking at as we go forward, there really isn't a literature that exists on that.
Well, that would be defined as precisely why, wouldn't it? Because there have been no long-term studies because it hasn't been long enough that we've been consuming genetically modified food. It makes sense that, for example, you can say about a foodborne pathogen how dangerous it is and how it's the major threat to our food supply. But that's because it's so immediate, its effect.
Right.
Versus, you know, like you say, these little amounts that we're getting GMOs, you know, it may take decades before, we develop the tumors.
Yeah, it may take decades now, but because we are eating them in small quantities, but as the nature of the kinds of crops that come forward changes, I think that ratio is going to change. Even now, we're eating sweet corn that's 100% genetically modified as opposed to a corn chip, which only has a small percentage of it is genetically modified.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some people worry that we'd want to know in advance whether something was going to cause a neurological damage if we eat it for 10 years, rather than waiting and then dealing with it after the fact.
Right.
But I think what the FDA has decided, less so the European agency that looks at this, but what the FDA has decided is that there's no reason to worry. There's no evidence to date, which I think is essentially what you were saying, Lynn. There's no evidence to date that there's any harm being done by genetically modifying foods. And I think even the critics would agree with that. There is no evidence to date that it's harmful. But as I said, as the nature of the products change with time, and they certainly will, that whole ratio may change.
I'm wondering, Laura, I know you're a scientist, but you're also a journalist. And as a journalist, have you gathered just some overall, call it intuition, call it, just a conclusion from your body of research and study and putting everything together that has left you with a feeling either way. I mean, I think that a lot of people would just say, well, it's just my philosophy. I don't want to put something fake into my body.
I think that's right. I think it, particularly in Europe, Europeans seem to be more sensitive about the food that they eat. Americans, at least up until now, they've been fairly accepting, although I'm not sure everybody understands what exactly is in our food supply, and maybe they would feel differently if they knew. But by and large, Americans are, you know, go after, to a large extent, buy what they can afford to buy and what they like to buy, and they're not really concerned about that. There is, as I'm sure you're aware, there is a movement to label genetically modified food so that people who do have an issue with it, whether it's just philosophical or it's scientific, they can have the choice. But if you're asking my personal opinion, I think the body of evidence that is presented to the FDA and the European agencies is impressive, what the companies provide in the way of safety data. But it's not scientific in the sense that, you know, the way science works is that, you know, a scientist has a finding, and if it's something that people are interested in, and hopefully for most of the scientists it is, then other people will replicate it, and then it'll become part of the body of literature for that field once it's been shown that this is, in fact, true and it can be replicated. That doesn't exist for genetically modified foods. There is no independent assessment of the safety of the food, so we're relying on the FDA and the companies to be doing the right thing. And up until now, it's worked.
Yeah,
but I think as a scientist, it's very unsatisfying to see that. But it is. It gets down to economics. Who would pay for these studies? They're difficult studies to do, expensive studies to do. The companies don't have to do them, clearly, because they're doing just fine with the way things are. So there isn't the motivation to do this, except in these rare cases where this, you know, group in France has really been banging on this issue of safety of genetically modified foods for some number of years now, and they managed to cobble together the funds to do these experiments. But nobody, there's no agency set aside the task of looking at long-term effects of any food, by the way, not just genetically modified foods. Any new food that enters the food supply, no food is tested. Genetically modified foods, the reason we made that statement at the beginning of the article that you mentioned earlier, John, is that genetically modified foods are the only ones that go through the kind of pre-market review that they do at the moment. So it is really an issue for any new food that enters the food supply, not just genetically modified foods.
And as you mentioned in the article, the business practice, I believe, is a 90-day evaluation.
That's sort of the standard. That's correct.
And the difference between Europe and the United States, as you state in the article, is in Europe you can't get a food on the market until it's met a certain safety criteria, and in this country the FDA can't stop something from going on the market. They have to go to court to get it off the market.
But I should also say that legally companies are mandated to provide safe foods, and so the FDA holds them to that standard. So, and the companies take it seriously, and I think they cooperate with the FDA on this voluntary consultancy that they do with genetically modified foods, because it gives them and the public the reassurance that these foods are safe.
We're speaking this morning with Laura DeFrancesco, wrote a fascinating article, How Safe Does Transgenic Food Need to Be, in this month's issue of Nature Biotechnology. This has nothing to do with science or your article, but I have to believe that one of the other reasons that people distrust the genetically modified foods is because some of the big guys like Monsanto have so much lobbying power. We may believe in what scientists tell us, but we're not necessarily sure if we should believe anything that Monsanto tells us.
And that's the tragedy, quite frankly, because I think because of the kinds of business practices that we are increasingly becoming aware of, companies like Monsanto do, it's tainted the field. There's a lot of good that genetic engineering and can do. I mean, the papaya crop is one example. I don't know if you saw the recent article in the New York Times about a citrus pathogen, which is almost wiping out the Florida citrus industry. And they're now turning to genetic engineering because that's their last hope to save the crop. And they didn't even want to because they knew they were afraid there would be some resistance to genetically modified foods. So these situations can be really helped by genetic modification. But because of the businesses, the practices that have gone on that have really left a bad taste in people's mouths, it's tainted the field, and I think it's most unfortunate. I think there's a real place for genetically engineered foods. I'm not necessarily saying what they've produced so far are the best examples. That's the other thing that's been kind of disappointing. They really haven't addressed consumer needs. They've helped farmers, to be sure, and that's significant. But they haven't really addressed consumer needs. And my hope is that as they do that, that this will bring a better feeling for these foods, these new foods, because people will see a reason for them. And I think the citrus example and the papaya example are two good ones of how it can really help.
And I read on the web that, well, you know, there might be a little bit of a conflict of interest. I read on the web that the six largest producers of genetically engineered seeds, Monsanto, Syngenta, Dow, BASF, Bayer, and Pioneer, which is DuPont, are also the biggest producers of chemical herbicides and insecticides. So, but, you know, that's a public relations thing, and that has nothing to do with our conversation this morning. But I think that has something, has a lot to do with the lightning rod of criticism towards this.
Absolutely.
Now, I have a question, Laura. You know, going back to, you know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, we don't need to do that. We take the example of the papaya and the citrus, where an entire, season of crops can be saved with genetic modification. That is certainly where the value is. Now, going back to something you said early on in the conversation, is that, in the past, we've seen genetic modification to benefit crops, you know, more from a farmer perspective. And we're going to go forward getting more GMOs into our diet as they relate to a consumer and nutrition and that sort of thing. And this is where I find it to be the most alarming, and especially when you look at these two words that the FDA uses, that food needs to be of, quote, substantial equivalence.
Yes, yes.
And that's, I mean, so if you develop this piece of cardboard and you put in all of the genetically modified components that give it some nutrition, and it ends up being defined as substantially equivalent, that's fine, right? As far as it's regulated now by the FDA. Is that right?
I mean, yeah, but I think it's a little deeper than that. I mean, it sounds easy to say substantial equivalence, but in order to prove that, the companies actually do jump through quite a few hoops. They do provide quite substantial amount of information about the plants. They compare it compositionally to its closest relative. They look for toxins and allergens and whatnot. So it's not quite, you know, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. They do actually look in some detail. And I think that the marketplace would take care of the scenario you just described. I mean, if somebody did produce cardboard, I mean, nobody would want it. And I think to some extent, the market is left to make some of these decisions on its own. But the FDA does take some time, and the companies do provide quite substantial dossiers that look at the properties of these plants. What's the gap that we identified had to do with long-term consumption and the lack of evidence to say that they're safe. And,
right.
And again, up until now, that hasn't been an issue.
Looking into the future, I understand that genetically engineered salmon has now been approved, and I guess the claim is that it grows at twice the normal rate. Could this open the floodgates for genetically engineered cows and pigs? And I mean, what's next?
You know, I haven't spent much time looking into transgenic animals, and I'm not exactly sure, unless it happened recently, I'm not exactly sure that transgenic salmon has been approved. I think it's been found to be safe. I think the FDA studied, and it's been studied for, oh gosh, I don't know how many decades. They really did took quite a lot of time in evaluating this particular salmon. But I think it hasn't been given market approval yet. Transgenic animals probably go through a different process than plants.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't know what's coming along the line for cows and pigs. I happen to know of a company that genetically engineered cows to produce human antibodies. That was potentially to produce large amounts of immunoglobulin for things like anthrax and smallpox. And the cows would produce much more of it. I mean, in for some things, they use human immunoglobulin, but you have to, you know, get human to donate it. In this case, they could engineer the cow to produce whatever immunoglobulin
right.
was needed. So there are things like that. I think they were working on genetically or making transgenic pigs that reduced or removed the antigens that would be rejected in a transplant situation, so that you could potentially use them as a source of organs. I don't know how far they've gotten with that.
Lots going on, that's for sure. We're speaking this morning with Lauro DiFrancesco. You know, I did okay with the pronunciation in the beginning. Now I'm just hammering it.
Yes,
but anyway, she's written a fascinating article, How Safe Does Transgenic Food Need to Be, in this month's issue of Nature Biotechnology. Laura, thanks so much for being on our show this morning.
Well, thanks for your interest. It's really been fun talking to both of you.
Yeah,
thanks,
and please come back.
Oh, I'd love to.
Okay.
And this is Cool Science Radio. And let's talk quickly about our cool story. We've only got a minute or two left. But, you know, today, this morning at 5:15 or 5:13 a.m., the moon reached its full potential. And it is called the you-know-what this month?
The harvest moon.
The harvest moon. And I'm a romantic, so I love to talk about the full moon. But, you know, you may not be a romantic, I think maybe you are, but you liked the science of the moon.
I do.
I just think it's beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, it's if it wasn't for the moon, we wouldn't be here. Because when we started out a long time ago, we were wobbling on our axes, and the moon's gravitational force from, well, between 235 and 250,000 miles away, depending upon what time of the month, actually stabilized the Earth and allowed us to crawl out of the primordial goop, or whatever they call it.
Goop. Gunk. Yeah, that's pretty good stuff. And talking about the harvest moon, although we associate it typically with autumn, this year's version is actually the last full moon of the summer season. And it's not very often that a season gets four full moons. A season only usually gets three full moons. So this summer has four full moons. I like that. And a lot of times the harvest moon happens in October, but this year it's obviously in September.
I would like to invite everybody to go out at exactly 9 o'clock tonight and howl in Park City. We can howl at the full moon.
I like that. And again, about this full moon, it's one of the only full moons where the moon is in the sky the entire time it's dark. And then some. I mean, it was still here this morning. You could see it once it was light.
Yes, for 24 hours, day and night, the full moon will be in the visible sky.
Oh, 24 hours. Yeah. I was going for just darkness.
Yeah, you can see it right now, actually.
Very good. I like this. We have just one more word from our underwriters, and we'll be back. You're listening to Cool Science Radio.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells.
And we want to thank Molly Wagster and Laura DiFrancesco, our guests this morning. And we'd also like to thank our underwriters, 350 Main and the Spur, San Francisco Design, and Prudential Real Estate. This is KPCW Park City.